Hello, everyone. This is Dark Journalist. Today, I have a special part two episode for you with Oxford scholar Dr. Joseph Farrell. We'll go deep on the 75th anniversary of the Roswell incident and the overhang of the Nazi Bell technology in connection with new information on the Kecksburg UFO incident.
And, okay, if you've got Nazis flying a bunch of exotic stuff around in our airspace 2 years after the end of World War II, you've got a problem.
Please join us now.
Van Herk and his Roswell connection. We're coming 75th anniversary of the Roswell incident in July.
Uh-huh.
75th anniversary on Kenneth Arnold and his sighting.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we floated before that they could be part of the same thing. You did an entire book on Roswell and the Reich, which is an unusual book, to say the least. And
it's the book ufology loves to ignore.
This is an intense book, 400 pages, and you've got a lot in there. But just since we're at that anniversary, what you put forward in Roswell and the Reich, fundamentally, in a nutshell?
Number one, it was not an extraterrestrial crashed craft. Number two, it was not a weather balloon.
Right.
Number three, the Air Force went to great lengths to make sure that you thought one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Number four, too much of the technology resembles something Nazi. Number five, this is admitted by Air Force documents that ufology loves to appeal to as it's arguing for the ET case. Unfortunately, the documents to which they're appealing are fabricated to the extent that they took a genuine document and overlaid some aspects of it with the ET stuff. When you take that stuff out and look at the original document, what the Air Force is concerned about are Nazis.
Mm.
So in other words, I'm saying that what crashed there and the reason they went to extreme lengths to cover it up with the weather balloon and ET narratives was because it was a crash of something Nazi that was not under our control, and that it was therefore coming from somewhere else. And okay, if you've got Nazis flying a bunch of exotic stuff around in our airspace 2 years after the end of World War II, you've got a problem.
Yeah, that's the other part.
That's not the other part.
To be gone by 47.
Yeah, we should be dealing with these people. Except to help us launch rockets, but, you know.
Right. Well, they're all integrated into our program.
Yeah, they're all integrated now. There are Nazis, so that means they're good. You know. It's just breathtaking when you stop and consider what we did.
Yeah, right. Yes.
Yeah.
And you detailed it really well. Actually, that structure, I think, because there were ideas. I was looking at this original paperclip book by Clarence Lasby.
Yeah.
And one of the fascinating things that he says, which is something that you've really outlined, is that this command structure that came out of Nazi Germany was reinstituted in NASA. So you're not just having the same people work together. Their positions are
Are exactly the same as they were.
That's pretty unbelievable.
And I'm not the one that brought that out. It was Linda Hunt.
Right.
And when I read that, I thought, oh boy.
Wow. Yeah. Because
she's right. If you look at what they're doing and where they are, they're exactly where you would expect them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, Kurt Davis.
Yes.
Now, in my reconstruction of all this crazy Nazi International stuff, what I maintain is, yes, Apollo really went to the moon.
Mm-hmm.
Number two, it didn't quite do it like we were told.
Right.
Number three, we had to make a bargain with the Nazis to do it, to get our hands on some of the technology that they had.
Right.
And therefore, we're going to have somebody as a liaison to control both aspects of that story. Voila, Kurt Davis.
Yes.
Why? Because Kurt Davis, the guy who is the German Nazi who's in charge of the Apollo flights at Cape Canaveral, this is the boss, a Nazi. Okay. And we know he was a Nazi because U.S. Army counterintelligence had to follow up on an accusation from someone that he had betrayed a colleague of his in Nazi Germany to the Gestapo.
Amazing.
So U.S. Army counterintelligence reopened his file.
Wow.
Okay. This is the guy that ends up in charge of the
Apollo. Even they didn't trust him.
Even they didn't trust him. He ends up in charge of the Apollo program. Now, here's the point. Kurt Davis is not a rocket scientist at all. His scientific and technical specialty is high voltage plasma research and measurement.
Hmm.
Does that ring a bell?
Now that you mention it,
yeah. There you go. You know, and by the way, this is also the man that subsequently ends up in charge of NASA's UFO files.
Oh, that's the thing.
Yeah, that.
Right.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yeah.
Oh, and by the way, he ends up on the board of OTROG, that weird little West German company that has 250,000 square acres or some phenomenal amount of territory in the Congo.
The Congo. This is African Area 51.
Yeah, it's an African Area 51. And we know about that thanks to Mikhail Gorbachev, by the way.
You're right.
Who's the one that disclosed it all? So, you know, there clearly is something going on.
Gorbachev has really contributed a lot.
Oh, yeah.
He actually, he gave a speech at the Texas School Book Depository. Mm-hmm. About how far advanced Kennedy was, that he felt like we were just catching up to what this guy was doing. Uh-huh. And but that's, do you think that's a strange place for him to give a speech? I mean,
Gorbachev, come on. This is the former general secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, who was mentored by Yuri Andropov.
Right.
So if anyone knows where all the skeletons are buried, it's probably Mikhail Gorbachev. And, you know, if I were Gorbachev and wanting to send messages about John F. Kennedy, the first place I'd pick would be the school book depository.
Yes.
This is a very carefully calculating man.
Yeah.
And he does not. He's not a fly-by-night guy that's just dribbling out, you know, accidental slips of the tongue. No.
Right.
No, he's doing this very deliberately. Why wouldn't you
would imagine, okay, the Kennedy Library, you know, is somewhere there. Texas School Book Depository, that's where the assassination's
exactly. Place. Well, I mean, look, Gorbachev... If you're the contemporary government of the Russian Federation and you want to put out certain types of information, who do you turn to? Who has a lot of moral respectability in the world from the former Soviet days? Mikhail Gorbachev.
Yeah.
So if you want to communicate certain messages in a non-official way, who do you turn to? Well, someone that's recognizable instantly on the global stage, someone who has global stature, someone who is recognized as an expert in Soviet-American relations, Mikhail Gorbachev. You know, this is an obvious thing for the Russians to do. And I have no doubt that they briefed him very, very carefully, vetted his speech, you know, even said, you know, instead of saying this, say that, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he would absolutely do it. And he's a loyal Russian.
Absolutely. You know, it's fascinating because, and he's made statements around the Kennedy assassination, like the Warren Commission wasn't interested in getting to the truth. That's pretty powerful.
That's very powerful.
Yeah. Even from a diplomatic basis. And it makes me think, and I wanted to get your commentary on this, because Judge Napolitano, this video has been surfacing now. It actually took place, the conversation, I think in February, mm-hmm. but it was Gerald Celente and Judge Napolitano discussing about when Napolitano was close with Trump around mm-hmm. the time when he was going to release all these records relating mm-hmm. to the JFK assassination, and he did release some, mm-hmm. Although the CIA, the main records got blocked. So they're in this conversation, and he's
saying, and what he releases shows Hitler was alive and well in Latin America. You know,
yeah, right.
What has that to do with President Kennedy?
That was like, you know, give him a morsel, and maybe they won't come back for the main
course. Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah, go chase Adolf.
That was fascinating. But one of the things that Trump says to Napolitano, Napolitano freaks out and he's like, you have to release those records. Don't let the CIA talk you out of it. Mm-hmm. And Trump says, no, you don't understand. You don't understand what's in those records. I can't let them out. And he says, why? And he says, Andrew, if you saw what was in those records, you couldn't let them out either.
Yeah.
So it is true that there's something in those records after all.
Yeah.
So, speculation maybe, but do you think that there's some kind of mechanism the Kennedys left behind in that record making, which would be, you know, if that stuff got out, would rock the things? And is it related to the UFO file?
Oh, it very well could be.
Yeah.
It very well could be. Let's do a bit of reverse engineering here and tie this to what Mr. Gorbachev said. There's no doubt in my mind that there probably was inside of the Soviet Union in the final days of Khrushchev, and just as Kosygin and Brezhnev are about to step in and take power, that there probably was a Soviet equivalent to the Warren Commission.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was conducted probably by the GRU and KGB, you know, cooperating together, and done in the utmost secrecy to find out exactly who was behind it and how it had been put together. We know of a similar study being done in France for President de Gaulle.
Mm-hmm.
So it stands to reason that the Soviets, who had the most at stake geopolitically at the time with the assassination, would have done a similar study. They may have concluded, given Gorbachev's comment, they may have concluded that there was something about the assassination that, had, were it ever to be disclosed, would end the American deep state, and they may be sitting on it and threatening, you know, from time to time to release it. I would not be a bit surprised. Because remember, James Angleton's whole Soviet mole hunt inside the CIA is being conducted right at the time that the assassination was taking place.
Exactly.
And Angleton was convinced that there was a Soviet mole. And mm-hmm. he turned the CIA upside down looking for it. Now, here's the problem. Either you have to believe that Angleton was simply paranoid and delusional and seeing things that weren't there, or given the nature of the man and what he was after, you have to conclude the opposite, that he knew and had enough evidence and he was literally looking to expose that mole. Well, if there was a mole, then the Soviets would be in a position to know the architecture of whatever mechanism conducted the assassination and whatever mechanism the Kennedys may have left behind. And I think you're on to something about them leaving something behind.
Interesting.
I think you're on to something.
Well, I think about Bobby Kennedy immediately getting the CIA director right after it and saying, you have to meet me at this farm in Virginia now.
Yep.
That conversation and what took place there, it yep. just seems like, you know, Bobby Kennedy was just like that as well.
Yeah.
And if he felt, okay, you know, there's this linkage here, I'm going to leave it there. And so if you try this again, or this is something that's going to surface, I do feel that Trump saying, you know, after being, hey, I want to get all this stuff out, for him to be freaked out is pretty hardcore.
For Trump to do the reversal on Napolitano means that he either saw something or was threatened.
Right.
My suspicion is the latter, given all the crap that he went through during his administration from the deep state.
Yeah.
From, you know, basically from the Bush Clinton crowd.
Exactly.
Because that's really what he was threatening.
Right. It's not Democrats only by long.
No, not at all. You know, as far as I'm concerned, the Bush family is the real operational center of that franchise.
Mm-hmm.
The Clintons are just kind of the public shills for it. But
they don't have the clout of the Bushes.
Oh, that nowhere near. And isn't it great that George P. Bush got such a drubbing in the
title? Oh, yeah.
I just thought I'd toss that out. Right. I was doffing my hat to those Texas voters. Yeah, good choice, folks. But for Trump to do that kind of reversal, the political pressure on him had to be very significant. What it may have been, I don't know. The obvious choice is threats on his family,
mm-hmm.
Which I think probably was the first choice for that group of people, because Trump just sort of caved.
Yeah.
We didn't see, but the other part of it, I think was this implicit threat, because he just sort of caved in at that point.
It's quite uncharacteristic.
It was.
Yeah.
It was. You know, this is why I have misgivings about him doing a run in 2024. I have misgivings about anyone that's willing to shut down the economy for a kooky narrative like that.
Well, he lost so much credibility with his own followers.
Oh, yeah, he did. He did.
What level is that, which is, oh, I'm going to give up my own base to do this? That doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't, which means that the threat level is very high. You know, whoever was backing him initially turned on him, and this is the disturbing thing that we have to take account of.
Well, let's just think about the Alex Jones type crowd that backed him so heavily. Right. They're so fully against it.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense. You'd lose all your own support base.
Right.
So there is something very strange there with Trump. I mean, we know that Trump, you mentioned the McCarthy piece, Roy Cohn connects directly from McCarthy directly into Trump. So Trump comes in. And through his uncle and other things, as we've talked about before, he's got that connection into the UFO file.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
And that's a strange piece hanging out there with him and Space Force and all the weirdness that's gone on, including the fact that his son interviewed him about Roswell.
There is something going on with both Hillary and Trump regarding the UFO, because I personally think that Hillary was the anointed one for you know,
yes,
the UFO disclosure, and then Trump came along and, you know, that was scotched. But then he does these very strange things, as you say, with not only the Space Force but the two Space Forces. You know, we need another one. It's exact. We have one already, and we need another one. Okay. And then there was General Milley at the U.S. Air Force Academy, you know, Mr. Woke General, talking about, you're going to have to learn to fight little green men.
Yes.
Oh, really? And then the Army backtracks on that and says, well, that's just code for the kind of camouflage uniforms that the Russians wear.
Sorry, you let the cat out of the bag.
Yeah, sorry. No, that's not it at all. No.
There's two pieces here, Joseph, I want to ask you about. And one of them connects directly to your research around the Nazi Belt, which I still think you know, is loaded with meaning. And I would like the whole alternative field to pick up on what you've put out about the bell. And I think it's in some ways they have adopted some of it, but it really, I think, is where the core of so much of the Nazi technology argument should go. So a strange thing happened recently, which was that a huge treasure hunter group, this is the story anyway, said that they tracked a Civil War shipment of gold from the U.S. Mint going through. And this time they decided not to send it by train, but it went by this protected horse cart. And that it got lost somewhere along the way. So supposedly they had found it somewhere between
a 100-mile radius from Kecksburg, Pennsylvania.
Oh!
And they didn't want to say exactly where it was. It was somewhere in that stretch of land right there. So they call in this group, which does an underground scan of everything that's going on there, and they find this huge piece that's down there. And what do? They go to the FBI with it and say, we think we've located this and all the rest. So the FBI says, okay, we're going to go in with you and do this. And thanks for the tip and all the rest of it. And then strange things start to happen around the site, which is all these people become aware that there are these planes in there, there's digging going on and all the rest. So the treasure hunters get called in a couple of weeks later and shown a big hole and says, you know what? There was nothing there. It was some weird anomaly. And forget about it. And so they freak out and say, no, we think we've got this gold. Like, what happened to it? And the FBI starts doing really heavy-duty denials against these people. And then a lot of strange witnesses come forward. And the story floats out in AP News.
This is fascinating.
This is what I want to ask you. Uh-huh. I'm going to put the gold part aside for a moment.
Uh-huh.
If something landed in Kecksburg in 65, which uh-huh. looked a lot like the Nazi bell after all, this uh-huh. is the weirdness about that. And you've pointed out that similarity. And there is a distance of about 20 years between that development of the bell and the Kecksburg acorn, uh-huh. Uh-huh. which has incredible witnesses just as wide as the Roswell case. And in fact,
better, in my opinion.
Better, yeah. More unfiltered and more modern.
Uh-huh.
And that story was heavily, heavily shut down mm-hmm. on the government side. Mm-hmm. But what do you think of them finding just a huge something right close by there and then the problem that arose with the FBI? Do you think they could have been looking at something else?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. After hearing you describe the story, absolutely. And you know exactly where I think they probably are going to go with it and where I would prefer to go is they may have found a portion of that device or all of it.
Yeah.
Now, according to the Kecksburg story, the government came in, they did recover the device, they put it on the back of a truck, flatbed semi, under a canvas and hauled it off, and eventually it made its way to Wright-Patterson Air Base, where another truck driver had to bring in a load of ceramic bricks and saw this thing under a canopy.
Interesting. Okay?
And to me, the ceramic bricks are a giveaway because if you recall the bell story, Igor Vitkovsky maintains that the bell was tested when it was tested underground inside a room that was blocked off with ceramic bricks.
Fascinating.
Now, if you haven't watched Tino von Struckmann's video
yes.
of his visit to the Bell facilities and watch them because it is absolutely crystal clear from what he shows you that this was an immense facility and that there was gobs of electrical power washing around all over that place. But
fascinating.
Oh yeah, it really is. When I saw these pictures, I thought, oh boy. But the ceramic tiles were what made the connection, not just the shape of the two objects, but the ceramic tile was the detail in the Kecksburg story that really convinced me that we may be dealing, if not with the same object, then perhaps with the same technology.
Wow.
Would the FBI cover that up? You betcha.
Yes.
You betcha.
I mean, it's basically a torsion physics object.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And they would need the incredible precautions that they took. If they were just pulling out a stagecoach, you know, from the U.S. Mint era. I mean, I don't know if you'd need all the things that were described there. And also the fact that they, the group that found it, that does the underground LIDAR detection, has a good reputation. So they, there was definitely something there. And to just come up empty and tell these people, oh, you didn't find anything. But it was the location that bothered me.
Well, it bothers me too. And, you know, when the Kecksburg Acorn crashed, it was apparently in some sort of distress or difficulty.
Yeah.
So it may be that, you know, a piece of it, you know, flew off or exploded off or whatever, was projected, you know, over to where the FBI did their dig. And again, the other thing you have to remember is that the Kecksburg Acorn came down and circled around the village and came up to the village from the southeast. It was the overall track was from the northwest, but the thing itself made a kind of a loop. So it may have, during that loop part of its trajectory, may have ejected something somewhere else, and that may be what found.
Fascinating.
So, you know, I don't have any difficulty, at least as far as the details that you're talking about, that may connect the stories together. Would the FBI be interested in recovering part of that object? You bet.
You bet. You know, it's so interesting because that area, the more I look into Western Pennsylvania, a lot of strangeness. And Moon, Pennsylvania, with its very secretive post-World War II community being set up there, actually is a much better Area 51-style location hiding in plain sight, in my opinion. But the Kecksburg thing is always fascinating because of its resemblance to the Bell 1, which you've pointed out. Here's the question. If they had developed the Bell at this point, does it make sense then that it would have become something like a UFO?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. The difference between the Kecksburg Acorn and the Nazi Bell is if you take at face value all of the details that Igor Vitkovsky put in his book. Remember, all I'm doing is I'm reverse engineering the details in his book.
Right.
That's all I'm doing. The details are from Igor Vitkovsky. What he records is that all the Bell did was it glowed, kind of a pale bluish glow, and emitted kind of a buzzing sound. The German nickname for it was der Bienenstock, the beehive. And it levitated, and that's all it did. It just, you know, went up and came down. You know, it's not doing maneuvers, in other words. The Kecksburg Acorn, on the contrary, and the other thing about the Bell is if you read Vitkovsky's details carefully enough, what you end up with is a device, it's levitating and doing all sorts of strange stuff, but it is connected by electrical cables to installations on the ground.
Wow.
Okay. The Kecksburg Acorn is not connected by any such cables. The witnesses who see it coming tracking down from Canada over Michigan all record that once it gets over Ohio, it makes a slight bend. So in other words, it makes a maneuver and then it makes that final maneuver before it crashes near Kecksburg.
Under intelligence control.
Under some kind of control from somewhere, either inside the object or out. The object itself does not look like it had anyone inside of it. And there's no connection of a physical nature to anything on the ground. So you're dealing in that sense with two different technologies. But technologies very clearly.
Yeah.
So could you have advanced the technology from 1944 to 1965 to that degree? Possibly.
Well, it's interesting because they must have been – the secretive nature, which you've gone through about the Bell, we didn't even know about it until the German reunification.
Right.
And which means that's a gap of 45 years of nobody even hearing about this thing. Right. Just weird echoes that the Nazis had flying saucers and they had all these different things. Now, what's interesting is once the Bell comes out, it's the first indication of this type of technology being in use in Nazi Germany.
Right.
And so it does stand out, and it does, since we didn't have that information when the Kexburg case hits, mm-hmm. you know, the resemblance, I mean, the resemblance is powerful.
It's very powerful. Let me make one correction. There were, since the beginning of the post-war period, there were always rumors about Nazi flying saucers. However, when you look at those rumors, you know, the Hanabu story, the Vril story, you know, which, as far as I'm concerned, people, and I'm sorry if you believe that stuff, because I think it's just post-war neo-Nazi excretum power. But what fascinated me about the Bell story was, contrary to the Hanabu business of, you know, all of this post-war Nazis, neo-Nazi stuff, was that there were details in the Bell story that could be conceptually reverse engineered.
Uh-huh.
You follow me? In other mm-hmm. words, when Igor Vitkovsky published the details of the Bell story, he's the one that records the cherry red, gooey, mercury-like substance, serum 525. He's the one that records the sound that it makes. He's the one that records that you've got two counter-rotating cylinders. Okay.
Right.
In other words, he puts out all these details, and he claims that the details are coming from an affidavit by an SS general by the name of Jakob Sporenberg that was tried by a post-war Polish war crimes trials court. Okay. He does not give you the affidavit. Hmm. What he gives you are the details from it.
Interesting.
So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, okay, how do we verify the story? The only way to verify the story is to take those details and see if they can be conceptually reverse engineered to figure out a plausible physics that the Nazis might have been trying to experiment with.
Right.
So that's exactly the kind of case I'm arguing here. It's a case based on another case that mentions these details.
Okay? Interesting.
I'm trying to synthesize all of these details in such a way that it could make a plausible case for what they were doing.
So it matched up.
So that it matched up, right.
Yeah.
Igor himself never attempts to go very much into the possible physics other than by pointing out that a modern plasma experiment can also look like the Bell. And he shows a picture of a Bell-like looking device that is made to handle a plasma trap, it's called, from the Institute of Plasma Physics at the University of Warsaw. So, you know, you can see this picture of this thing in the book. And Igor points out that what the Nazis' genius was they engineered a plasma trap that rotated the plasma.
Right.
An ordinary plasma trap will not do that. So, but he doesn't pursue it any further than that. So the question then becomes, why were the Nazis rotating a plasma in a plasma trap?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on we could go. Oh. So that's what I'm trying to do in those books about the Bell. I'm trying to reverse engineer a conceptual matrix that the Nazis may have been operating with. And when you add to that picture the scientists that Vitkovsky says were involved with it, it becomes pretty clear that they were involved in some sort of torsion physics based on a rotating plasma.
Wow. You said about torsion physics that it makes the atomic bomb look like a firecracker.
If you master that kind of physics, if that's what you're tinkering, I didn't say it about the atomic bomb, I said it about the hydrogen bomb. It would make the hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker.
Wow.
If you weaponize it.
Fascinating.
You know that statement in the book of Revelation where it says that the heavens will roll up like a curtain?
Oh.
It's torsion physics.
Unbelievable. Wow. That's powerful language right there.
Yeah, that's powerful language.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. Now let's remember something else. all of the details that Igor provides also connect some of those details to Richter in Argentina. Why? Because it's the same company involved, Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft. Who's working for the Allgemeine Elektrizitätsgesellschaft in World War II? Kurt Davis.
Oh, there he's again.
There he is again. Voila.
Right in the middle of it.
Right in the middle of it.
Yeah. Oh, man.
And what does Richter say that he's actually doing with his fusion experiments for Juan Perón? Well, the first thing he says is he's rotating the plasma.
Wow.
Using, and he even says, Lamour precession frequency. And, oh, yeah, I found out about, you know, this plasma fusion reaction in 1936 when I was, you know, pulsing plasma with gobs of electricity, rotating plasma.
Wow.
Not just stable. So, in other words, none of this fits the thermonuclear chemistry thinking of the day.
Right.
None of it.
So if we were to really connect the dots on that, it looks like this Bell technology was sent over to Argentina and they just continued developing it.
Yeah. Yes, that's exactly what I'm arguing. When you put all those books together, that's exactly what I'm arguing. And if you have someone like Davis involved at a certain stage of the project, and then he ends up in charge of Project Apollo, that's, for me, the clinching part of the argument, that we made a deal to get our hands on some of this stuff. And then after the deal comes after 1965, which is the Kecksburg incident. Isn't that interesting?
It's true. The timing is incredible. The timing is
interesting.
Well, it's interesting, whenever you get around the bell, and one of the things you outlined is the amount of scientists that they killed at the end of World War II, so the secret didn't get out. That's right. Part of the affidavits, too.
Yes, it is. It is.
What does that tell you?
What it tells me is the Soviets, if you've got the Polish puppet state for the post-war Soviet bloc, trying an SS general, a four-star SS general, and he's saying all of this, okay? Either we're dealing with a very good Soviet disinformation operation, which I doubt we are, because there's too many details that Witkowski does not mention in his book that couple with Richter in Argentina. Follow me?
Yes.
Okay. If you look at those details, I don't think the Soviets would be wanting to point fingers at Richter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But what it also means is that if it is not a Soviet disinformation operation, then they know and would have done exactly what I did in the Bell books and try to reverse engineer the concepts behind it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what I think they did.
Yes.
Who else says that? Tom Bearden.
Mm-hmm.
And what does Colonel Bearden say? What did he keep harping on when he was alive? That Stalin, when the Americans exploded the atomic bomb, literally whiplashed the Soviet Academy of Sciences to scour every journal in the Western literature that they could and find some area that could be weaponized and do an end run around this nuclear monopoly for the Soviet Union.
Wow.
And would something like that come to their attention? You betcha.
Unbelievable.
So when Dmitry Medvedev says we have other means.
That development.
Yeah, sure. You think we're the only ones doing black projects? No, sorry. Chinese, the Russians, the Germans, the French, the British, you know, even the Canadians, they're all gonna get on this bandwagon.
You mean with that hero Justin Trudeau at the helm?
Well, no, not Trudeau. But you go back to the post-war stuff going on inside of Canada, and it's, you know, the Avro car and all of that stuff.
Oh yeah. Well, it seems like the secrecy in Canada is even denser than in the U.S. somehow.
Yeah, yeah. You know, they're supposed to be peaceful people. But we don't do any of this. No, no.
Joseph, I have to ask you, and just connecting the dots on that whole bell thing, which I think you've outlined dramatically in your works, and I think we have a much better picture of what that was now, because, you know, we see superficial treatments of this thing. It's like, oh, some kind of wonderful, weird thing, you know. Mm-hmm. But you've really used that information that's out there to bring it forward. The thing about the bell, taking it from this Hans Kammler development period, which you brought forward a lot about Kammler, and there is a book that came out called The Hidden Nazi, mm-hmm. which I think puts a lot of meat on the bones for the Kammler stuff. And you've been talking mm-hmm. about Kammler for years. Mm-hmm. But it is interesting. And he's another Nazi, as you point out, who has like 10 different death scenarios. Mm-hmm. But if we look at Kammler and what he has the Bell Project under his umbrella. Mm-hmm. And he's looking at the end of the war. And the idea is he could be the key person to set up all the Bell pieces to be sent mm-hmm. over to Argentina so they can continue mm-hmm. to develop that as part of the post-war mm-hmm. Fascist group. And then the scientists left behind on the ground so that they don't fall into those Soviet hands. They get all bumped off, but with enough of their notes and all the rest of it. So this is the dot I want to connect. Kammler, Argentina into Kecksburg mm-hmm. and the UFO.
Oh, uh-huh.
How do you do that?
Very easily. That book that you mentioned, The Hidden Nazi.
Yeah.
The authors of that gave me a copy.
Great.
Because essentially what they're arguing in that book is that Kammler came to this country.
Yes.
Okay. Now, if you read my books, I say, no, Kammler went to Argentina. Mm-hmm. Okay. And here's the thing that I'm so glad you asked this question, because I have actually been thinking about this in the last couple of months. I've been okay. thinking about Kammler again. We've got Kammleritis or something. But the interesting thing about General Kammler is that, like Martin Bormann, there's lots of post-war sightings of him. And I never put all of this together until very recently. It just occurred to me. Okay, he's seen or alleged to have been in the United States. I argue a case that he went to Argentina. Some people maintain, and this is very interesting to me, some people maintain that he was alive and well in Prague, just up the street, so to speak, from his headquarters at Pilsen. Okay? And I'm thinking, okay, what if we're not dealing again with a case that one of these scenarios has to be right, but that they all are?
Oh, yeah.
If you are a post-war Nazi in charge of a project like that, that began in Czechoslovakia, was shipped to Argentina, somehow ended up way in the north of Canada, and then made its way to a crash in Pennsylvania, you know, you're going to be a guy that gets around.
Mm.
Particularly if you've got American cover.
Right.
Or particularly if you're making deals between the United States and the Soviet Union and you're the go-between.
Wow. Yeah.
That one opened up all sorts of possibilities.
Yes.
Because if you're going to be doing that sort of wheeling and dealing, you could get people into the Soviet Union and out for the right collateral. And if you're coordinating...
It makes me think of Oswald immediately.
That's exactly where I was going. And if you're coordinating launches between the two space programs, you know, so there we are.
He's got the access.
He's got the access. He would be a logical person to assume that, okay, the Soviets have their reverse engineered Bell hypothesis. Well, who are we going to check that against? If you know where Hans Kammler is, and particularly if he's in Prague, you're going to, you know, send the NKVD, soon to be the KGB, you know, a column.
Right. Right. Absolutely. And this guy is young enough.
Yeah.
If we're looking at 20 years later, 65,
yeah.
You know, I mean, just like von Braun, these guys were young enough to be totally in their prime when they get into the 60s with the major space program.
Actually. Sure.
Exactly. So Kommler had that, you know, he could have lived into the 80s.
By some accounts, he did.
Joseph, absolutely fascinating. You know, I didn't want to forget to ask you something, which I made a note about, which has to do with nuclear and UFO. So just do this, and I know I've kept you a long time, but this is really fascinating.
That's right.
And off the charts, too, because I hope that this, you know, because of that Kommler book, it is interesting, but you pointed out something else too, which is that they didn't have Kommler in Argentina in that book, which is an odd omission.
Yeah, I think it's the one problem with their book is they're tracking the man, not the technology, and I think you have to do both.
I gotcha. Yeah,
because they're both part of the same story, effectively.
Absolutely.
I think they lay out their case very well, and I think they've argued it very well. So I'm thinking, okay, well then we have to modify what all of this means, because we have to, you know, I like to look at the total picture. It's the same approach that always has bothered me with JFK assassination research. You know, you've got the people that say the mafia did it, or the CIA did it, or the, you know, no, everybody's involved. You know,
yes,
it's exactly what Jack Ruby said. This was larger than anybody can possibly imagine.
Yes, absolutely. Because when you look at the mafia, you think, what does NASA have to do with the mafia?
Yeah, precisely. Exactly.
You once indicated that it was one of the possible triggers for all this alien awareness of what we were doing, or the wave of UFOs, et cetera, had to do not so much with the action of detonating a nuclear bomb, but something about the development and the process of that, which attracted their interest. And I always wanted to follow up and ask what that was. You said it was something about the action. It wasn't about, oh, we're setting off nuclear bombs. It was the action of the nuclear combination itself that attracted them.
Okay. Well, let me put it this way. I believe that nuclear bombs, when you detonate them, transduce energy from the zero point energy. In other words, the yield, that these are not closed systems, they're open systems. And therefore, that the yield of a nuclear device, particularly the larger the device in terms of its yield, the more you're going to be able to detect this.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So we're talking hydrogen bomb territory. That when those types of devices are detonated, they act as transducers for the zero point energy, and therefore the yield is going to vary according to the time and place you set them off.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now there's this idea was first broached by Bruce Cathy, a New Zealand author. And he is right in terms of the basic insight that he had. I think he's utterly wrong because he also maintained that you could only set nuclear devices off at specific times and places. Otherwise, they wouldn't work.
Hmm.
Now, I'm saying they will always work, but they will vary depending on the geometry of local space-time. And again, to construct a nuclear device, the precision engineering that's involved is all about geometry, mm-hmm. and the geometry of the wave interference in those first initial nanoseconds of the reaction. Okay, it's at that instant that you are tapping into the energy of the local lattice structure of space-time. Okay, that's my thinking. Now, what that means is that there's going to be, in addition to the longitudinal shockwave of the bomb in, you know, in the air or under the water or whatever medium that you're setting it off in, that there's also going to be a longitudinal pulse in that latticework of space-time. Follow me? Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you have a technology that can detect that wave moving through that latticework, you will be able to pinpoint the, and that wave will be, in my opinion, most possibly superluminal. Okay? Mm-hmm. You will be able to detect precisely where that detonation took place simply by the latticework displacement. Now, I know that sounds kooky and crazy, but remember what a longitudinal wave is. I've got my back scratcher here. Okay. A normal wave, when people think of waves, they think of sine waves, the up and down waves. So imagine you and I have a jump rope suspended between us, and you or me jerks that rope up and down. Okay. And that wave travels to the other person. Well, most of the energy between whoever's jerking the rope and whoever's holding on to the other end, most of that energy is dissipated in that undulating up and down motion. That's a sine wave. That's not a longitudinal wave. A longitudinal wave is like I suspend this back scratcher between you and me. Mm-hmm. And I push and pulse it. That energy translates entirely to you in that instant. That's what a longitudinal pulse will do.
Okay.
And that's what a longitudinal pulse in the medium will do.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Tesla had stumbled onto.
Right.
Was electromagnetic, or as I like to call them, electroacoustic longitudinal pulses.
Hmm.
That's why he was so opposed all of his life to Einstein. Okay.
Yes.
He was talking about longitudinal pulses in the medium.
Fascinating.
And that's powerful. Now, let me go one step further for you, since we're on this subject. You've heard of Thomas Townsend Brown.
Yes.
Okay. He's the American physicist that tinkered around with electrogravitation. All right. In 1955, you can look this up, Townsend Brown proposed what he called Project Winterhaven. Okay. And this was right at the time the U.S. Navy was showing interest in his work, and also interest in his piezoelectric work, okay? This is right about the time that Townsend Brown is going to go to work for, guess who? Lockheed Martin.
Oh.
Yeah, that's a connection most people don't know about.
He's going to regret that, too.
Yeah, he's going to regret that. But he comes out with this Project Winterhaven as a proposal for supporting electrogravitic research from the U.S. Navy. Part of the proposal says that we propose to develop means of detection of longitudinal waves in the medium. And if I remember the context correctly, he's proposing this precisely as a means of detecting nuclear blasts.
Oh.
So in other words, what I'm suggesting is he's thinking exactly along these lines.
Yeah.
So, you know, we're back to square one. I think there is an off the books physics, and it has little to do with Albert Einstein and relativity theory, and for that matter, probably not much to do with contemporary standard model quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
Although more to do with that than relativity theory. So, you know, you're dealing with different physics. Yeah, it is.
Well, that's interesting to me, too, because when you mentioned Brown in 55, I think about Jessup and the Philadelphia experiment.
Bingo.
And that very special edition of his book.
That makes its way into the hands of Wernher von Braun.
Yes.
Bingo. Yeah. This is all interconnected. This is all interconnected.
And of course, that's, you know, Jessup is primetime UFO file.
Yep. Very much so. Very much so. And he dies under incredibly, in my opinion, highly suspicious circumstances.
He's dusted off.
He's dusted off. Yeah.
Yeah. What's interesting is when I went into his background, I found out that his best friend was J. Manson Valentine.
That's right.
Who finds Casey's Bimini Wall prediction.
Yep, exactly.
That's quite a thread.
That's quite a thread. That's quite a thread.
An off-the-books physics and also off-the-books projects there.
Yeah. Well, remember, you know, remember what Jessup said in his case for the UFO is if you found a means of having a standing wave collimated in the air, you could literally create an invisible column of air that would be as hard as concrete or steel.
Wow.
That's Jessup.
Incredible.
And he's proposing that as a means of trying to explain why some plane crashes appear to be so weird, like as if they'd run into something in midair.
Made me think of the Moses Pillar of Fire.
Ding, ding. Ding, ding, ding. You know, I'm not opposed to the idea of God using technology. You know, I'm a sacramentalist. That's what we do, you know.
Joseph, incredible. It's so great to have you back.
And thanks for having me back.
We're so glad you're doing well, and you're
doing. Well, I want to thank people for the prayers and good thoughts. I'm convinced I wouldn't be here if it weren't for those. I really am.
How incredible to have you back, and you seem better than ever. And I will send you that gold story because I want to.
Oh, definitely, I want to read this. Yeah,
I think we got the Kecksburg connection going.
I mean, come on, folks! You can't resist Confederate or Union gold and Kecksburg all in the same mix.
Can we get you in to write a new book? That's the question.
The Confederacy and ET. What was really behind General Beauregard's success at Fort Sumter?
I can feel ancient aliens ripping you off right now.
Yeah, right now. It's all a Confederate plot.
Of course, everyone can go to Giza Death Star to get become a member and see all your work there. And the books, I want to always emphasize that this book is so ahead of its time. This is going back now to 2015, 2016. Yeah. And there's so much of what they're trying to push out now with the UFO file and these things that if you just go back here, the secret space program, celestial psyops, and hidden conflicts, that's covert wars and breakaway civilization. You got to have that in your canon if you're going to know what's going on now.
Yeah, the problem is these people are so predictable. Get a new playbook, guys, if you want to rule the world.
Joseph, quick prediction, outcomes in Ukraine?
Well, just on a purely bean counting note, there's no way that the Ukraine can win this.
Yeah.
The sad fact of the matter is the Ukraine is kind of like France was for Great Britain during World War I. You know, we're going to fight the Hun to the last drop of French blood.
In
this case, we're going to fight the evil Russians to the last drop of Ukrainian blood. I feel sorry for the Ukrainians
because, oh my god, yeah,
you know, they are being used as a cat's paw in a much bigger game. It depends on how long the West wants to prolong this. I don't see any other outcome, however, either way, a prolonged war or a short one, other than disaster for Mr. Globalone.
Yeah.
I really don't see any other way for them out of this. If the Ukraine were smart, and their current leadership clearly is not, if they were smart, they would get out of this as soon as they can. And yes. And if that means not joining the EU and not joining NATO, so be it. They're going to end up a big landlocked country if they're not careful. And sooner or later, they're going to have to play ball with the Russians one way or the other. There's just no two ways about it. How are Russia and China going to maintain their alliance?
Wow.
I already see some signs of it beginning to show some strain.
Wow. That really makes so much sense. They overplayed the hand on the Western side, and the Russians come in there and clean their clock. And now, facing up to that kind of disaster, what are these people going to do? That is so fascinating. They do seem to be using Ukraine for a number of different things.
And other objectives.
Yeah.
And part of this, I don't think, is even about trying to bring down Putin. I think it's about trying to cover their own you-know-whats. Wow. The Biden family, right at the top of the list.
Excellent point.
You know, yeah. the Russians are already exposing the biolabs. They're already putting these Western mercenaries, British, French, American, they're going to put them on trial.
Wow.
In Moscow. And, you know, more power to them. That's where they should be on trial.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, they're going to expose all this. So, you know, the West has two choices, escalate or get out.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the two. And the Russians are perfectly willing. I mean, you're dealing with people don't get this. The Russians have never accepted the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. They know a nuclear war is going to be horrible. They know that. No one knows how horrible war can be better than the Russians. They've True. Been through two world wars, lost one, won the other.
Yeah.
And, you know, they know. But when they say that they are capable and will go nuclear if they are provoked in a certain way, they mean it.
Yes.
They mean it. And the bad news for Mr. Globaloney is I don't think the Russians, just like as they've done in the Ukraine, they're attempting to minimize civilian casualties as much as they can. They are taking out infrastructure and the military potential. So Mr. Globaloney better think twice. Because the Russians know where they live, and it doesn't take a cruise missile. They can do it with the Spetsnaz team.
Wow.
You know, and folks, I know I've said this before, covert operations are a game that two can play.
Right.
And, you know, you're dealing with a Russia that's now willing to take the gloves off. If you want to talk about overthrowing Mr. Putin, fine. We can overthrow people too.
Yeah.
Yep.
No question about it. And it's so fascinating because when we look at how they've approached this, you know, everything that they've done up to now is backfiring on them.
Who, the West?
On the West side. So, you know, everyone's starting to see the disaster of the Ukraine for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But also for the fact that we don't have a peace process in there. You've got Blinken in there, one of the worst secretaries of state ever.
And the Russians aren't returning his phone calls.
Right.
Until just very recently, apparently.
And that's that whole expansion of NATO right into Russia. You know, so we know that whole provocative game. So we saw this coming and we sort of dared them in.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And this is a game that I think they've played upside down, and they've taken us to the brink of mm-hmm. nuclear war, which is a disaster.
It was a complete disaster. I really hope Mr. Globaloney, that Mr. Schwab and Bill Gates and, you know, that whole coterie of swine and excrement are listening. Because if they go there, the first targets for the Russians are not going to be Boston, Massachusetts, and planting a hydrogen bomb right on top of Harvard Square. Although the Russians would have good cause to do that.
just give me some notice before that.
Give Daniel some notice before you drop a hydrogen bomb on, you know. No, they're not going to do that. They are going to be very precise in their targeting, and they are going to go for Mr. Globalone's headquarters, their families, you know, all of that stuff. Yep. They will decapitate that serpent once and for all.
Mm-hmm.
And it may not necessarily come in the form of hypersonic cruise missiles. Like I say, it could come in the form of Spetsnaz, a little prick with an umbrella full of polonium. You know, who knows?
Wow.
But, you know, they will do it. Mm-hmm. Mark my words. And if, you know, and that means we're not their primary target.
Right.
I hope people hear me. We are not their primary target. Their primary target that they have been addressing for years is the leadership class of the West.
So better never start underestimate a desperate enemy like that.
No, never, never. Especially the Russians. No. No, and God help us if the Chinese decide to get involved. You know.
Yeah, right.
No. We don't have the military strength to confront either country conventionally. I want to reiterate that. We do not have the military strength to confront either country conventionally. We've got the biggest navy, but those aircraft carriers are missile magnets.
Mm-hmm.
And the rest of our military is, how to put it, up to its earlobes in the sewage of wokeism.
Oh, right.
I wouldn't put it against either the Chinese or the Russians for 5 minutes.
Wow. Well, we have John Kirby, the spokesman at the Pentagon, crying at the podium. I mean,
Yeah.
I mean, that weakness is a temptation, you know.
Of course it is.
Just like the disaster in Afghanistan. So this is where we stand.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. This is not a good geopolitical situation, and it's of our making.
Do you think that this conflict can bring out the UFO tech aspect because it will be used by one side or the other?
Could.
Yeah.
It could. I would opine that probably if it's going to be used, it's going to be used by the West first.
Right.
Because we're the desperate ones.
Yeah.
Russia's not desperate. Russia's not. I mean, watching the Russians play the financial angle to this, it's like a masterclass in economic warfare.
It seems like they've stood up really well, oddly enough.
Putin saying, pay for all your gas in rubles. And by the way, folks, we're putting a gold floor under the ruble.
Wow.
Didn't see that one coming, did you? You know, I'm just stunned. And, you know, it's an obvious thing for him to have done. I mean, you know, we've got our own states in this country passing these bullion laws. So we knew, you know, we should have seen this one coming, and we're going to fight this with paper dollars and a woke military with Joe Biden as head of the country.
Oh my God.
No, folks. No.
One way or another, somehow gold is in the air today.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you'll notice that they waited to do this until after Trump was out of office and Biden, you know, Bidenenko, Brandenenko, you know, the whole corrupt Biden family and their whole grift is in power. And now he can't even think straight, you know, and not that he ever could, but no, this, none of this is accidental timing. None of it. And the Ukraine itself, if you want to transship weapons, this is where to do it. If you want to make sure weapons get into the wrong hands, criminal hands, this is how you do it. You know, this is going to get very ugly before it's all over. And I think the Russians, you know, with the business of how they've been handling the bio labs and what they've been discovering, this is going to turn into a PR nightmare for Mr. Globalone. We've been, to put it bluntly, we've been caught red-handed.
Wow.
Red-handed.
Yeah. Unbelievable. Joseph, it's great to see you.
Good to see you, sir. Thanks for having me back.
I'll be in touch.
Oh, cool. Thank you. Take it easy, Daniel. Thanks for having me back.
Hey, it's fantastic to see you.
All right. Thank you. You too.
All right. We talk soon.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Joseph, just amazing. We'll have you back on soon for round two of the UFO hearings and the UFO anniversary. Please join us on Friday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern for the Dark Journalist X series. See you soon.